So the conversation that developed yesterday ahead of some sunny, warmer weather here was, has the Lansing area had a killing frost so far this season? I want to say we've had a light frost, at least. I'm not sure it was considered a killing frost. That gets a little squishy there. But that's important to weather purists, if you're a weather purist, because it's not Indian summer unless it's been preceded by a killing frost, right? So we're going to have to go back and check the books and have a few more conversations about that, I guess. It's current state here on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. We come to you three times daily here on WKAR, 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. on 90.5 FM, and every weekday at noon on AM 870. We're always at WKAR.org. As the former emergency manager of the city of Flint, our first guest has come under fire recently. Some are blaming Darnell Early for not stopping or reversing the city's 2013 decision to switch its water source to the Flint River. That move led to dangerously high lead levels in drinking water. Mr. Early left his Flint position early this year. Today he's the EM for the Detroit Public Schools, trying to right the historically troubled district. It faces more than $500 million in debt and numerous academic challenges. In both roles, the ordained Baptist deacon has remained a resident of Delta Township adjacent to Lansing. Darnell Early, welcome back to Current State.
Thank you, Mark.
You've taken a lot of criticism for downplaying your role in Flint's transition to river water. You have claimed, among other things, that the plan was already in place when you arrived. Tell us more about that.
Well, again, contrary to the reports in the media and other rhetoric, the decision to switch to the KWA, which is the Karagandhi Water Authority that was put together in Genesee County, that decision was made at the local level by local civic leaders before I began my term as emergency manager. And the decision to separate from Detroit Water and Sewerage Department and to go forward with the Karagandhi Water Authority also included the decision to pump Flint River water in the interim. And both were a part of a long-term plan that was approved by Flint's mayor and confirmed by the city council on a vote of 7-1 on March 25 of 2013. This plan was presented to me when I was appointed as Flint emergency manager in October of 2013, a full 7 months after the city council's affirmative vote. And I think what's key here, Mark, is that people should understand that coming out of the long-term contract with DWSD, there had always been discussions about an alternative water source. And the Flint River has served as the backup for the water source for a number of years. And that was the rationale given to me by staff when they presented the plan to me. Just like any other appointment I've had as a city manager, county administrator, when I come into a city or a school district, I meet with staff, I find out what the issues are, where are you in terms of the things that you've done before. This was one of the issues, obviously, was the contract with DWSD was ending, and it ended on the 14th of April of 2014. But that was a plan already underway, and the rationale, as I said, was given to me. So my role in that particular portion of it was just to make sure that the things that needed to get done got done, because under Public Act 436, the emergency manager does have the authority to execute the legal documents regarding the operation of the city.
A number of critics, though, seem to be saying that any person assigned the responsibility and the title of emergency manager who is familiar with the situation should have intervened and stopped the plan.
Well, there was no reason for me to. I mean, there was no indication at any point, obviously. What we know now was a possible consequence. Staff was working consistently with the State Department of Environmental Quality, with its engineers. The plan was on track to switch from the DWSD to the Flint River for the next 18 months to 2 years when the KWA is supposed to be completed. I had no reason to second guess that. There was nothing given to me that said in April of 2014 that we shouldn't do it.
Tons of people, though, with a good deal of justification, I think, are calling out for accountability. You've had time to consider this. Who should be held accountable for what's happened?
Well, there are a lot of people that are involved in the process. The process is more than just saying, yes, we're going to go with the Flint River. I mean, the process is ending a, I think it was 50-year contract with Detroit Water and Sewer, wherein the city was just another customer, into going with the KWA and also providing an alternative water source that the city could afford going forward. The plan included all of those elements when I got there in October. There were two emergency managers who oversaw that switch from the DWSD until I got there and obviously saw the final implementation of the switch. But I don't go into a situation and just arbitrarily start changing what's already in place. I work with the staff and with the elected officials to the extent that they're willing to work with an emergency manager to keep moving forward with what they have in place. And
but could you say the DEQ dropped the ball here, though?
You know, Mark, I don't want to say who did what because I'm not privy to all those conversations. I don't know from a factual basis, you know, what those decisions were made, be they EPA, be they the staff at the city of Flint. They're the ones that treat the water. You know, the emergency managers don't treat the water. They treat the water based on the guidelines provided to them by the regulatory agency. So I want to refrain from saying someone is responsible because that will all come out, obviously, when there is a review of this matter in terms of whose responsibility was what and how well that responsibility was carried out.
Well, in retrospect, 2020 hindsight, do you feel you were sufficiently aware of the details of Flint's challenges there with regard to the quality of the Flint River water, for example?
Well, again, that decision was made, and of course they had all of the requisite sign-offs and approvals to do it. So that was not an issue for me. The only time that became an issue was when the water started flowing and they started having problems with it. And one of the first things I did was to enlist a consultant, a water quality consultant, to come in and take a look at that. So from April until about December, we worked trying to figure out what the issues were and correct them. I was more concerned with finding solutions to the problems than second-guessing the local elected officials and the staff and the State Department of Environmental Quality.
Darnell Early is the emergency manager for the Detroit Public Schools, former emergency manager for the city of Flint. We're talking about challenges and issues associated with both of those roles. It's not uncommon that emergency managers change before a municipality or a school district emerges from emergency status. You went to Flint when Michael Brown resigned, and the city was not out of emergency status. When we're talking emergency management as it's practiced in Michigan here, should changing horses in the middle of the stream be avoided?
No, I think that in the case of a distressed community or a school district, the emergency manager has the responsibility, I believe, to go in and lay out a plan for his or her term and follow that plan. Now, when that individual leaves, as I did in January of this year, then another emergency manager was appointed and basically kept the plan moving forward so that ultimately, the city could emerge from from emergency management. And I think that there's a lot of misconception about the role of emergency managers in Michigan, which compounds the discussion. We are, in my particular case, we're public administrators. We're managers. I do no different in my role as a city manager than I do as an emergency manager. That includes strategic planning. It includes assessment. It includes the kind of things that I would do to manage a city or a school district. So change happens inevitably, and just depending on how the previous emergency manager has approached his or her role, it's for all intents and purposes is a seamless change. When I left, there were still contract issues to be resolved. I think the emergency manager appointed after I left Flint followed those, and the goal was to turn the city back over to the local officials once there was a financial plan in place and some of those issues were taken care of.
I've got to ask you one other thing here, though. One line from the op-ed that you wrote that appeared in the Detroit News, quote, "It did not fall to me to question, second guess, or invalidate the actions taken prior to my appointment," unquote. And that's basically what you've been telling us here today. It's clear Given the way that the water decision turned out, doesn't this beg the question, were there other decisions made prior to your arrival that you didn't second guess that may also have been wrong? Is that possible?
Well, I don't think so, Mark, because here again, once the regulatory agencies approved the use of the water supply, and once the staff understood what had to happen to make the water potable, and once the effort was made to move forward and to retrofit the treatment plant to cover the water, I mean, it was a functional plan. What happened was the unintended consequences of a negative outcome relative to the requirements for treating river water, as well as the aged infrastructure of the distribution systems, and thereby creating the lead issues that are in the news today.
Congressman Kildee is calling for an EPA investigation. The governor's appointed a task force. Do you think that any investigation would absolve you of any culpability here?
Well, I'm not so much concerned about that because I know what the facts are. And anyone who looks at the facts will see that this entire project didn't just start in April of 2013 or 14, whatever the case might be. This is a long-term discussion about using the Flint River as a potential water source. It came out as a alternative to the switch from the long-term contract from DWSD to KWA, but all of the requisite requirements and all of the due diligence had been done. And so there was no reason. In fact, no one came to me and told me, you got to undo this or you got to change this. I mean, that was not an issue.
The water crisis has triggered, predictably, another heated conversation about the value of the emergency manager law itself. You alluded to this earlier. How do you try to persuade critics of the law of its value?
Well, you know, it's just like any other situation where there is a need for intervention. And what I found managing in distressed communities, both in the cities and townships and now in school districts, is that these areas are pretty much consumed with the lack of revenue, lack of tax base, and all those things that create, if you would, a perfect storm towards some form of economic or financial distress. And if they continue along the path without some change, we don't see a change in their ability to make the tough decisions. Emergency managers are brought in to intervene for a brief period of time. It's 18 months. The idea being that the things that need to get done are under the auspice of the state's appointed emergency manager to get those done. And so I would argue that without that, the city of Flint would be in a lot worse financial and other difficulty. The city of Detroit, obviously, we know where that would be, but for the good work of the emergency manager and so many people who were a part of that. So I would argue that there is a place and a need for that, and people should probably try and understand more what it is instead of automatically condemning it because of the reasons that have been cited.
We've got to switch gears here in the time that we have left to talk about the Detroit schools situation. The governor's plan is out there and is on the table. You appeared last week at the legislature about the plan. It creates a legacy school district that retains $715 billion or so?
No, million. That's million.
$715 million, I beg your pardon.
With an M.
M, not a B. And it creates a new district that would be funded, at least initially, by the state. Remind us of what were the thrust of your comments at the legislature last week?
Well, I think it's important for the legislature to understand, and this begins the discussion. As you may or may not know, the bills and the details have yet to be introduced. I think they're coming very soon. But in the meantime, we use that time, the state treasurer and I, to share with the House Appropriations Subcommittee on the issues that we think are important. And they are, number one, that I can't cut enough money out of the budget and lay off enough people and still remain solvent to deal with that debt issue. So if we take away the debt issue, which is roughly about $515 million, with about $200,000 to start up a new Detroit community schools. If we do that, we're in a much better position to manage our way out of the predicted issues of of lower revenues and expenditures and loss in student enrollment, just like any other district in Michigan. So what I want the legislature to understand is that when we talk about this new co and old co, we're actually talking about a new Detroit Community Schools that will function like any other school district in the state, but will be better able to manage itself around the same issues as other school districts have, because it won't have that that crushing deficit that comes right off the top of our operating to pay back.
Details aside, a lot of observers are saying this is going to be a really tough sell in the legislature. Have you gotten much response from after your appearance last week? Are you concerned?
Well, I think that there are more legislators now who want to know the facts. And, Mark, that is so important when you're talking about the issues of managing in distressed urban communities, because a lot of what you hear is not factual. For example, there was some trepidation about cutting other school funds to give them to Detroit, and that's not the issue. There is a tendency to believe that because Detroit have its history, and some of the financial challenges that it's had, will not be able to survive even if they give the money to Detroit or if they take care of the debt and pass the bills. But that's not true. Again, we're putting together a new Detroit community schools that will be manageable just like any other school district. And I think that the legislature, when they see that and understand that we're not talking about your perceptions or the general perceptions of what Detroit Public Schools represent, we're talking about the future. We're talking about an investment in the lives of some 47,000 students. And I would hope that that would lend itself to much more scrutiny and ask the questions. We can get you that information about the future, but we're on a path to do that.
Darnell Early is the emergency manager for the Detroit Public Schools. Prior to that, the emergency manager for the city of Flint. He's been our guest today. Darnell, thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. We've been checking in with Susan Woods the past few months for updates on the monthly East Lansing Indie Film Series. But the East Lansing Film Festival is a different animal. It's an event that only happens once a year, and it's kicking off this Thursday. Founder Susan Woods joins us today to talk about what we can expect from this year's festival. Welcome back, Susan.
Thank you.
Besides that it's just once a year, what else makes the East Lansing Film Festival different from the monthly event?
Well, we have more than just showing films over a month. What we do is that we have panel discussions. We have the Lake Michigan Film Competition films, which we award regional films. So all the films made by people in the states that surround Lake Michigan.
Mm-hmm. Now, the festival starts Thursday. What's the opening night event?
The opening night is Uncle John, and it's very exciting. This is a new indie film. It's a mystery thriller, and it stars John Ashton, whom everybody knows as Sergeant Taggart for the Beverly Hills Cop franchise.
Mm-hmm.
And he is going to be there, and he's coming, and it's considered a career-breaking role, so it's going to be fun.
He's in town for this.
Yes, yeah. He'll be there.
How exciting.
I told him he has to mingle with everybody. There's a party before and after, so we're going to get good use out of
him. He's got to mingle with everybody?
Everybody, I told him.
Oh, my. What other special guests are coming for the festival?
We have directors coming for almost every single film with the Lake Michigan Film Competition, which runs mostly Friday and Saturday. We have Michael Covino, who is the screenwriter and actor for the film Keep in Touch, which I consider a breakthrough film and has been in all major film festivals and is really something to see. And then on Veterans Day, Wednesday the 11th, we are doing an in-person tribute to Melissa Gilbert and Timothy Busfield. Melissa Gilbert from Little House on the Prairie and Timothy Busfield from Field of Dreams, 30-something, and a East Lansing native.
That's right. What, and what venues are the films being shown in?
They're going to be shown on Friday and Saturday at Wells Hall, but at Studio C starting on Thursday, the 5th, running all the way till the end of the film festival on the 12th.
Susan Woods is the director and founder of the East Lansing Film Festival, which starts on Thursday. We've selected some clips from some of the films in the festival. The first clip we have is from a movie called East Side Sushi. What's that about?
Oh, this is an amazing film because it has won more audience awards than any film I've seen almost ever. That means that it is a crowd pleaser, and it's about a Latina who has to get a job, and she ends up working at a sushi restaurant and then learns how to make sushi, but she blends it with Mexican cuisine, and it is just, it's heartwarming.
Let's hear a clip from the trailer.
You try to become sushi chef?
You want to become sushi chef? You go try another restaurant. Not here. It is not a job for you.
Yeah.
Sounds tense.
But it's fun. It's really fun.
There's a bunch of documentaries in the festival. One of them's about a man, yikes, who found a human foot.
Oh, my. This is my favorite film from Traverse City Film Festival. It is a documentary about a man who finds a human leg in a smoker that he got from an auction, a storage unit auction. And instead of returning it to the owner who lives in the town, he takes it and becomes a celebrity. And this is a documentary, everybody. This is not, and it is the funniest, but at the same time, it blends, you know, the tragedy of losing a leg and this other fellow. I think it's just a remarkable, remarkable film.
Finders Keepers, let's hear a clip from that trailer.
What's the problem there?
I got a human foot.
Have a what?
A human foot. And it's some nasty, got me grossed out.
I'd seen the grill and ended up buying it. And I opened the grill up, and there's the foot, you know, five toes and five toenails.
I'm flashing on Fargo there for some reason here. There's another documentary that might be of interest to our listeners because it's about a young woman from Flint. We were just talking about Flint, and we've actually spoken with Clarissa Shields on Current State before. The documentary is called T-Rex, and it's about her Olympic journey. What can you tell us about T-Rex?
It's a fantastic documentary. It's about, as you said, Clarissa, who was the first female boxer to win the Olympic gold. And you just see the determination of this woman. And it's just beautifully done. I highly recommend it.
Let's hear a clip from T-Rex.
It is a teenage phenom from Flint, Michigan.
I got to be able to take care of my family. I got to have enough money.
Clarissa places in the top eight. She will make the U.S. Olympic team.
What does it feel like to be a part of Olympic history?
That sounds good, but I know it's a catch to it.
It's a catch to everything.
You mentioned the event, or the tribute, I should say, to Melissa Gilbert and Timothy Busfield, who I think reside in Brighton these days.
Yes.
Tell us more about that.
Well, we're going to be showing clips from their different TV shows and movies. Where Mike Hughes from the Lansing State Journal, who's been interviewing them for 25 years, will be interviewing them on stage. And it's just going to be, you know, one of those great events. And we're giving them the first elfie. So we're going to be making an elf statue that we're going to hand out to them that is being made by the 3D printer from the East Lansing Public Library.
Perfect. This is a hometown event.
I know,
from
really,
start to finish.
Really.
I like this. When, where,
okay.
How much, open okay. to the public, all that stuff.
Okay. It is, please, everybody come out. This is a one-time event. It is starts on on Thursday, November 5th, runs all the way through the 12th. Almost every single film is being shown twice, so you'll get a chance to see them. At Studio C, we will be doing, the tickets are $10 and $8, and then at Wells, it's half price at $3 and $5.
And where can listeners go to get passes and tickets?
All the tickets at Studio C are being sold through Studio C, and then all the tickets at Wells Hall are sold at the door. And for the passes, I mean, for a pass that gets you into everything, parties, everything, that's online at elff.com, as well as the tribute tickets.
We'll also point out there's a documentary about Amy Winehouse,
yes,
who I'm sure has fans in the area. We've talked about this movie before, too, the Seymour, An Introduction, which is a documentary about Seymour, pianist Seymour Bernstein,
right,
and really the incredible impact that he had
has
as a teacher and
on everyone. And it's a beautiful film, and it's directed by Ethan Hawke, and very moving.
We want to thank our guest. Susan Woods is the director and founder of the East Lansing Film Festival. Hope you have time to enjoy this. You're not so distracted by details that you can enjoy this.
Mark, I have more fun than anyone deserves. So, yes, it is a great event.
Thanks, Susan. And coming up on Current State, last summer, Dana Nessel became a household name in Michigan. She's the attorney who represented April DeBoer and Jane Rouse in their legal fight to jointly adopt their children. Their case became part of the U.S. Supreme Court's watershed ruling last June, legalizing same-sex marriage. We'll talk to Dana Nessel about the new ballot campaign she's leading to provide LGBT protections under the Michigan Constitution. Plus, an empty GM parking lot on West Saginaw in Lansing is a little brighter now, thanks to a new public art installation created as part of a collaboration between MSU students and youth in the juvenile justice system. We'll hear more from Current State's April Van Buren about Project Restart. That and more after this break. If you've got a suggestion for a segment here on Current State, let us know about it. You can email us, currentstate@wkar.org. You can call me directly, Mark Bayshore, WKAR. I'm at 517-884-4776. Your feedback and thoughts are always welcome and encouraged. When the U.S. Supreme Court legalized same-sex marriage last June, countless gays and lesbians celebrated by reciting their vows. But the euphoria of the moment failed to rectify lingering discrimination that many feel in the workplace, hospitals, and elsewhere in society. Now, the Detroit attorney who stood at the center of that ruling is leading a campaign to provide constitutional protections for the LGBT community in Michigan. Dana Nessel represented April DeBoer and Jane Rouse, whose case overturned Michigan's ban on adoption by same-sex couples. Their case became part of the larger ruling that legalized same-sex marriage. Ms. Nessel is the co-chair of a new ballot campaign called Fair Michigan, which is hoping to put a question on the November 2016 ballot. Dana Nessel, welcome to Current State.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
The Michigan Constitution was written in 1963. It bans discrimination on the basis of religion, race, color, and national origin. Your proposed ballot amendment would add gender identity, and sexual orientation. Is this the first time these constitutional protections have been proposed here in Michigan?
I believe it's the first time it's been proposed for a constitutional amendment, correct.
Hmm. You're the co-chair of this new ballot committee, Fair Michigan. Tell us a little bit more about how it's come to be. How did this idea come together?
Well, I mean, the idea for me personally was because, you know, we received our ruling from the Supreme Court on the marriage case on a Friday, and by Monday morning I was already receiving calls from people who had told people at work that they had gotten married or who had tried to put their new spouse on their medical insurance at work, and when their employers discovered that they were in a same-sex marriage, they were promptly fired. And so that was really devastating for me to know that here we had made this you know, we had this monumental decision from the Supreme Court, but that people could still be fired or denied housing or education or even medical treatment, honestly, based on the fact that they were LGBT. And so it seemed very apparent to me that absolutely something had to be done about this issue.
Issues of gender identity and orientation and same-sex marriage have historically received more support from Democrats than Republicans. Are you trying to cultivate bipartisan support here?
Well, we already have, actually. And in fact, I'm co-chair, you mentioned, of Fair Michigan. Alongside me is Richard McClellan, who is a well-known GOP, you know, political operative. He's very well-known in Republican circles. And I think you're going to see that it's not just Democrats, it's not just the LGBT community that's going to be supporting this, but we're going to have business leaders, we're going to have Republicans all across the state. And, you know, there are a lot of people out there that don't believe anybody should lose their job based on their, you know, status as an LGBT person. So I think we're going to see widespread support. And our polling tells us, and we're polling very, very high in this matter, you know, that people across all demographics support this, regardless of their age or their gender, education, their race. I mean, we're going to have a lot of support from maybe even a lot of unusual places, I think, when this goes forward.
From where do you anticipate resistance?
Well, I mean, it's hard to say at this point. I mean, I imagine there are still some religious affiliations that may not support this and who just basically oppose people being LGBT in the first place and have an issue with that. But, you know, I think we've come a long way in this country and we've come a long way in this state. And I think you're going to see more and more Republicans, even people who might not have embraced the idea of a non-traditional marriage, meaning a marriage that was not between a man and a woman, who still don't think it's okay for people to get fired or be kicked out of their homes or be denied medical treatment based on the fact that somebody is LGBT.
We're talking about a new group called Fair Michigan. It's a bipartisan ballot committee that wants to add gender identity, and sexual orientation to the Equal Protection Clause of the Michigan Constitution. If they're successful, the question will appear a year from now on the November 2016 ballot. Our guest is Dana Nessel, a criminal defense attorney based in Detroit. She's the co-chair of the campaign, and she's best known perhaps as the attorney who represented April DeBoer and Jane Rouse at the U.S. Supreme Court in their decision to legalize same-sex marriage last June. Why is it still necessary to codify these protections in the Constitution? Can you make a case that the Supreme Court decision fell short?
Well, the Supreme Court decision, you know, related to one issue and one issue only, and that was marriage. And I think Justice Kennedy, in writing the majority decision, was very careful not to talk about anything else. Now, actually, about half the states in the country do have legislative protections for LGBT people. So this is not going to be novel at all. There are so many other states that already have these type of protections. Unfortunately, we have not seen any movement whatsoever in our state legislature in terms of adding these protections to Elliot Larson, which is our state civil rights law. And in fact, in the last 12 years, I think there's been about 12 bills that have been pending. And in all that time, I think we've only seen one hearing in one house in 12 years. So I talked to a lot of people in the state legislature who tell me there's about a 0% chance of this passing in order to provide these protections by the legislature anytime soon. So we think the best way to go about it is to take this to a vote of the people. And I think it's time that we give Michigan voters the power and the opportunity and the responsibility to bring our Constitution in line with our Michigan values.
It seems like there are some number of people who are always hesitant to tinker with the Constitution. And I'm not really sure why, but I think there are some of those people out there. Do you expect resistance just by taking it to the level of altering the state Constitution?
Well, you know, we've talked to a lot of people about this. And in fact, we added that issue into our polling on this. And really, the resounding answer that we got is, if protection against basic forms of discrimination does not belong in the Constitution, then what does belong in the Constitution? You know, I can understand people saying, well, whether or not we build a new bridge or whether or not we decide on a particular form of renewable energy, that should be statutory in nature.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what a constitution is for, is to protect classes of people against basic forms of discrimination. And so we're just asking that these groups of people, which I should tell you doesn't add just LGBT classes, but also it adds gender and sex. So people would be protected constitutionally against being discriminated upon based on their gender. So these are protections that people believe and understand belong in the Michigan Constitution.
You alluded to the other states that have already added these to their state constitutions. Have they been accepted? Has there been backlash? Do you know?
Well, obviously, gender and sex are in many, many other state constitutions. For LGBT protections, that is not the case. Most of that is done legislatively. But again, you know, part of us moving towards doing this constitutionally and doing it in the form of a ballot proposal comes because we have no movement or traction of any kind in the state legislature. And so that's why it's so important for us to do it this way. In terms of constitutional protections, I think one of the things that this will provide is a very, very difficult RFRA, or a Religious Freedom and Restoration Act, such as the kind that was proposed just last year in the Michigan legislature, which would really nullify any effort, because what we've seen proposed there are RFRAs that would allow anyone who had a sincerely held belief that being gay or lesbian or transgender was wrong could then deny basic services to somebody who was LGBT. So by putting it in the Constitution, we really protect against having to worry about any person saying, hey, I own a donut shop, you know, but it's against my beliefs that LGBT people, you know, should have any rights. So I'm going to refuse to, you know, to serve you. And that's what we didn't want to happen, you know. We didn't want the state legislature to provide an excuse why they could still deny basic treatment, even medical treatment, to an LGBT person. So that's why we believe that the best place for this is the Constitution, and I think the Michigan voters are going to agree.
Our guest is Dana Nessel, a criminal defense attorney based in Detroit and co-chair of a new group called Fair Michigan that wants to add gender identity, and sexual orientation to the Equal Protection Clause of the Michigan Constitution. This is a personal issue for you as well. You proposed to your partner last April. How have your own life experiences been involved in this? Have your own life experiences driven your professional work?
Well, I mean, I think that any time that you're personally affected by an issue, it makes the issue more consequential to me. But yeah, I mean, I'm in a same-sex marriage, and my wife and I have, you know, two young children, and I'm terrified at the thought that they could be discriminated against based on the fact that they have two moms. And they could. I mean, literally, if one of my sons wanted to sign up for a little league, he could be told, no, we're not going to do that because you have parents that are of the same gender. If I took my other son to the doctor and said, you know, my son is sick and, you know, can you provide treatment to him? He could be refused based on the fact that he's got two moms. I mean, it's so fundamental, and it's very scary for families in particular that have that are headed by, you know, same-sex couples to know that their children can be discriminated against so easily, and there's no recourse whatsoever. If that happened to me, or if that happened to some other family, there's literally nothing you can do. You can't sue. There's no law under which you could find relief, and it's a very scary thing for all LGBT people to have to face, I think.
We've just got a few seconds here, but I'm obligated to ask you about your work with April DeBoer and Jane Rouse. Were there moments of doubt for you during the litigation process?
Oh, I think certainly there were moments of doubt. But, you know, once we engaged and once we started the process, you know, we really felt as though there was no turning back. And the longer the case went on, the more confident we were in our case and the more confident that we were going to be successful. And I really, truly feel the same way about this ballot proposal. You know, I wouldn't engage in this process if I thought that we weren't going to be successful. And I just have every reason to believe with the broad-based coalition that we're forming and the amount of support that we're seeing out there, again, from all demographic areas, that this is going to be successful if we get it on the ballot.
Dana Nessel's been our guest. She's a Detroit-based attorney who is a co-chair of Fair Michigan, a committee seeking to put a question on the ballot next year to include gender, gender identity, and sexual orientation as part of the Equal Protection Clause of the Michigan Constitution. Dana Nessel, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. Have a great day.
This is Current State. You're listening to WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. The nights are darker. The wind is getting a little more biting, but some bright yellow and red leaves still cling to their branches. Today's public poetry announcement on Current State celebrates that symbolic shifting of the seasons. Here's director of the MSU Center for Poetry, Anita Skeen, reading In Blackwater Woods by Mary Oliver.
Look! The trees are turning their own bodies into pillars of light and giving off the rich fragrance of cinnamon and fulfillment. The long tapers of cattails are bursting and floating away over the blue shoulders of the ponds. And every pond, no matter what its name is nameless now. Every year, everything I have ever learned in my lifetime leads back to this, the fires in the Black River of loss, whose other side is salvation, whose meaning none of us will ever know. To live in this world, you must be able to do three things. To love what is mortal, to hold it against your bones, knowing your own life depends on it, and, when the time comes to let it go, to let it go.
In Blackwater Woods by Mary Oliver, being read by Anita Skeen. Our public poetry announcements are produced in partnership with the MSU Center for Poetry. It's Current State on WKAR. If you've driven down West Saginaw lately, you may have noticed a little more color. The installation of colorful mosaics on concrete barriers in an old GM parking lot is the work of Project Restart, a collaboration between Peckham, students from MSU's Residential College in the Arts and Humanities and the College of Engineering, which partnered with Adjudicated Youth to design and install the mosaics. Current State's April Van Buren went to the unveiling last week to talk to some of the people behind Lansing's newest piece of public art.
This strip of West Saginaw isn't particularly colorful. The empty parking lots and old auto factory sites are a depressing mix of gray, black, and brown on this rainy fall day. But then, something with a little sparkle catches your eye. In the middle of an empty parking lot, 12 concrete barricades covered with colorful glass mosaics stand out against this post-industrial backdrop. This public art installation was part of Peckham Inc.'s Next Step program, which works with youth in the juvenile justice system. Peckham Youth Services Specialist Amanda Adsit walks me down a bright yellow path painted onto the asphalt beside the installation.
So this first mosaic right here is the image of gears. We kind of did gears as a symbol that, you know, everything keeps moving and one piece can't move without another piece. And so that's kind of a symbol of all of us working together on this project.
This collaborative project took quite a few different gears, so to speak. Students from the Residential College in the Arts and Humanities and the College of Engineering at MSU worked alongside youth from Peckham to design and build the barriers. The group chose the parking lot of the former Lansing Metal Center as the site for their public art installation. The GM factory closed in 2006 and was demolished in 2008.
You know, now it stands barren. There's lots of weeds and it's just empty parking lots. And it's kind of dismal.
But Amanda says that's part of what drew the youth to this particular site.
They decided that they wanted to do something in an area of the city that was kind of empty. They wanted to give something back to an area that, you know, there wasn't a lot of hope in. So that's kind of how Project Restart began.
That was about 3 years ago. Today, dozens of people huddle under a big white tent with some hot cider and donuts to celebrate the project's unveiling. Vincent Delgado is one of them. He serves as the Dean for Civic Engagement at Michigan State University and was one of the facilitators for Project Restart. He says when the project began, they really didn't have any idea of what it would eventually look like. So he took some advice from his colleagues in the College of Engineering by starting with the problem.
And that problem was twofold. We have this huge post-industrial site where thousands of workers wrote their hopes and dreams throughout the years. And we had young people who perhaps should have been working in these places, and that could have been their hopes and dreams. But other things happened, and they wanted to write new hopes and dreams.
Crystal Sheeran was one of the youth who helped visualize what those hopes and dreams might look like as a piece of public art. She was a student in Peckham's Next Step program and designed one of the 12 concrete barricades. Crystal says when she was designing her barricade, she tried to take the things that were always heavy on her mind and then put them onto the paper.
So I came up with a little road map, because you're on your way to success, or the other one is the arrow, so down. So either you can go down or you can bring yourself back up.
The road stretches across 5 different panels with the words strive, potential, devotion, content, and courage on them. Crystal says those are the words she uses to motivate herself each day. But while she clearly put a lot of thought and a lot of heart into the design, Crystal says it wasn't actually her favorite part of the project.
The most fun was for me was breaking the glass. Breaking the glass and gluing it on the plaited sheet and just seeing what it's going to come out to look like.
Crystal and the other Peckham youth were teamed up with the students from MSU who helped bring the project from concept to reality.
To be honest, they carried the project. It was their ideas that they were coming up with. We were more of the facilitators, the people that listened to their ideas and wanted to make it come to life.
That's ARCA junior Liz Martin. She began working on Project Restart when she was just a freshman. We huddle under an umbrella next to the barricades as Liz tells me about the 3-year-long process of creating the installation. The group went through several different ideas of what to do with the space, including building a skate park, before they landed on the concrete barricade mosaics. But that was just the beginning. Next came sourcing materials and finding experts who could show them how to do it.
We found people that had expertise in mosaicing to come in and teach the students how to properly lay the glass onto the grout and make the grout stick onto the barriers. And obviously this isn't something that can happen overnight. As you can see, they're very intricate. And I'm just guessing there's probably around 1,000 pieces of glass on each barricade.
Liz says each barricade took about 3 months to finish. But now, 3 years later, what used to be an old vacant lot is brightened by the shimmering mosaics. Clear plastic squares with pictures of butterflies designed by Riddle Elementary students hang between 2 poles attached to each one. Vincent Delgado says he's already seen the space evolve in ways he didn't expect.
The other day I was out here and there were children playing. And so this is becoming a public space that's not just an art installation. The parents were telling them, stay on the green, which was a way of saying stay within the paint of this installation. And the kids were running around and sitting on the barricades and looking at their arts while their parents were walking through and talking about it. And I think that is what I'm hoping to see. And I think that's the type of public spaces we need to see more of.
And Amanda Adsit from Peckham says the impact is bigger than just the physical installation.
I think the opportunity to work alongside college students that were the same age as our students really kind of motivated them. The students that we're working with didn't all have a high school degree. Some of them, were dropouts. They were working on their GED. And to work with their peers that are going to college was inspirational.
She points out one of the barriers that she says sums up what Project Restart is all about. It features the hashtag #LoveLansing in bright red letters on a white background.
A lot of our students aren't proud of the city. And a big part of this project was trying to show them that there's a lot to be proud of in Lansing. And I don't know if you're on Twitter or Instagram, but, a lot of people hashtag love Lansing for things that they're proud of. And so that's why we did this piece.
Amanda says now the students have a permanent reminder that they made something to be proud of, too. For Current State, this is April Van Buren.
And that's our show for today. Coming up Tuesday, several former U.S. congressmen have joined a national effort called the Reformers Caucus, which is advocating for changes to the campaign finance system. Current State talks to former Michigan Congressman Bob Carr about the group's efforts. Plus, an interview with legendary dancer, choreographer Twyla Tharp ahead of a performance tomorrow night at the Wharton Center. All that and more tomorrow on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Wharf. April Van Buren directed our show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Melissa Benmark, Kevin Lavery, Jamie Paisley, Katie Cook, and Drew Hill. Current State is a podcast as well. We make it convenient to listen to our program. Get it on your smartphone every day. Just subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. We're also on social media, on Twitter, at KAR Current State, on Facebook, Current State from WKAR. Have a great day. Enjoy our Indian summer. We'll see you tomorrow on Current State from WKAR.